Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory. It's number 84. We're getting ready to head out to Summer League. Hopefully going to get some interviews out there. It's great to do a few podcasts out there. Obviously, there's a million people. It'll be great to talk to out there. Maybe some player interviews. Maybe some agents, executives. Who knows who we'll run into. So stay tuned. Subscribe, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher. And of course, we live stream on YouTube quite a bit. More stuff with Friends going to be coming soon over there. Obviously, Friends of Dome Theory make an appearance occasionally. Music episodes through the off season. Definitely want to dive into some of the best albums of 2022 so far that we haven't gotten a chance to talk to since the playoff run was going on and the Celtics had news left and right. That continues with Summer League this week. We'll be heading out there, mostly Celtics on the Summer League front, but hopefully some other features on some other teams and players coming as well. So stay tuned for all of that. Pacers fans, admirers of the Pacers, Tyrese Halliburton fans, you'll all enjoy this episode. Great friend of the podcast, Caitlin Cooper's back. Always bringing good insight on both the Celtics, Pacers, and league as a whole. Writer for Indie Cornrows. You can get her work at indiecornrows.com and at C2 underscore Cooper. And of course, we bring you Dome Theory. Thanks to BetOnline.ag. BetOnline, the number one spot for all your odds, futures, baseball, UFC going on from time to time, anything. NBA Summer League is available at BetOnline.ag. Go over there, use the code CLNS50, get 50% back on your first deposit. Even if you aren't betting, great place for all your sports stats, info, and if you're interested, your favorite Vegas casino games are there as well. Their website is sleek, clean, modern, updated, easy to navigate, whatever you're looking for. That left ticker with World Cup, baseball, basketball, boxing, football futures available as well as football season nears. And already, odds for tonight's Summer League games are up. Rockets, Magic, Grizzlies, Jazz. You also got NCAA futures. I mean, there's a million different things you can bet on right now at betonline.ag. And even if you're just interested in the odds, it is the place to go. Rookie season odds are up. Watching Chet Holmgren dominate in the Utah Summer League. Might be fun to bet on some of his over-unders. 13.5 points per game, 7.5 rebounds per game. There's just so much over at betonline.ag to do right now. And of course, go over there, use the code CLNS50 when you first sign up. You get 50% back. That's $50 when you bet $100 in, $150 to get started. And this is a great week to do it with Summer League getting underway tonight as we record this. Of course, Calm, big reason we'll be out at Summer League, Garn Report. Calm, day one Garn Report supporter this season. They've been with us the whole way. Great supporters of the show. We've enjoyed their product. We all use their product. And for me, it's the sleep sounds. For you, it might be yoga in the morning. It might be the meditations midday. I mean, there's a Calm. There's a Calm exercise for pretty much any point in your day, anyone. We all don't get to our center the same way. And Calm's got something for everyone, especially if you're using that premium version. And if you're going to use it, go to calm.com/garden, 40% off a premium subscription. Big help to the Garden Report. Big help to CLNS Media, as well as what we do here at Dome Theory. Appreciate that. Appreciate you listening. And here is Dome Theory 84 with Caitlin Cooper. Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome 84? Yeah, 84. And we are here with good friend of the show, great writer covering the Indiana Pacers, Caitlin Cooper. Feels like these two teams, Celtics, Pacers, we've been talking about them arm in arm for a minute. And finally, last week, they pulled off the trade at the most unexpected moment that I think a lot of us have talked about on the Celtics side and seemed to make sense from a Pacers perspective for a while here. Malcolm Brogdon to the Celtics, one of the bigger moves this offseason so far. I think a move that could have a big impact on the Celtics, but we're all left kind of saying, this price, this return, doesn't seem to add up when we were looking at this trade in the past and kind of kicking this one around. Caitlin, great to have you back. Hope you're doing well. Hope the summer's going great. What was your initial reaction to seeing Brogdon finally traded and traded for Tice, Nesmith, pick, and basically some filler contracts here?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me back on. Yeah, I think I was a little bit surprised. I mean, everyone in Indiana, I think, pretty much knew that at the very least, Malcolm Brogdon was not going to finish next season on the Indiana Pacers. I was going to be surprised if he even started next season on the Indiana Pacers, given what the little sample size was with Tyrese Halliburton and what the language had been around acquiring Tyrese Halliburton. They referred to him after that trade was done as their franchise point guard. They've compared him to a Boston reference, Tom Brady. They've compared him to Andrew Luck.
Really?
And, oh, yes, yes. That's how they see him moving forward. So it seemed like the writing was on the wall a little bit. Now, they did temper that once Brogdon was back and was healthy enough to play for those little sample size where Rick Carlisle essentially said, like, well, now we're going to have two point guards on the floor. But you could very much note, like, I think Rick Carlisle typically says things with a purpose. And when Malcolm Brogdon left the Milwaukee Bucks and signed with the Indiana Pacers and restricted free agency, he was asked and said, my ideal position is point guard. And I think that mattered to him a lot when he came over, that he wanted to be able to show people that he could play point guard. So it felt a little bit telling when Rick Carlisle was like, well, now we can have two point guards on the floor. So I'm interested to see how that's going to play out with the Celtics. Just in terms of the return, I think that that probably got diluted a bit when you look at what Malcolm's injury history has been. He hasn't played 60 games in three seasons. So I'm sure that that was probably a factor for Brad Stevens. And, you know, you never know exactly what the executives value. For the Pacers' perspective, that pick isn't going to be great. It's going to be probably close to the second round because the Pacers just gave the Celtics a player who's going to hopefully help them be better even than they were last year when they went to the NBA Finals, or at least equal to. So, but they do already have a pick potentially coming from the Cavaliers if the Cavs make the playoffs, and they'll have their own pick. So if you have three firsts, you know, there's potential that you have a lot of flexibility there. Maybe you can move up. Maybe you can do something. Maybe they really like Aaron Nesmith. And now there's a lot of rumors coming out that they might be throwing a max offer sheet at DeAndre Ayton. So doing that trade in the way that they did gave them that max slot. It gave them cap space. So maybe they really valued that in order to go after, you know, potentially their franchise center as well.
Yeah, the pick here, the big one for sure. It probably won't be a great pick, but it's something. And who knows what kind of pick compensation was out there otherwise for Brogdon. They did make the weird move. Last time we talked, we were kicking around maybe Brogdon being a fit on the Celtics or some other Pacers, and Smart going back and forth. We were trying to find the perfect trade here. And it did seem like Brogdon made sense for Boston before, but Indiana signed him to that extension that I think now takes him through 2025. Made him trade ineligible at the time through the end of the season. And it sort of put them in a tough spot. I wonder what the thinking was behind that extension, because it took away all their trade flexibility throughout the season. And I know when they signed it, they didn't have Halliburton at that point. But it's just been a weird tenure as a whole from Brogdon there. Like, it looked like he was going to be a centerpiece for Indiana in the early end of the contract when they were a pretty good playoff caliber team at that point. And then by the end of it, he sort of gets displaced there, but, you know, has that extension anyway that's sitting there. It's just such a weird tenure in the end, looking back on it, for Brogdon there. Injuries, role, you know, bounce around, multiple coaches. Just how do you look back at his tenure there?
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at that extension, I think we talked about that a little bit on our podcast as well, wondering, like, if that extension hadn't have happened, what would his trade value have been like at the end of the season versus having it? Because a lot of times we look at players in expiring situations and we think, you know, that's going to let a team lowball them because they're not going to have as much leverage. But in the case of Brogdon, when an opponent has to take on, you know, extra risk in case, you know, you don't know what his injury and his health status is going to be, I do wonder if that diluted his value a little bit. When they went into, you know, quote unquote rumor season, there was stuff put out there that maybe the Pacers could get number 10 or 11 from the Knicks or the Wizards. And then that shortly turned into, oh, that was never a possibility. And then also, like, well, Brogdon's actually a negative trade asset. Like, Indiana might have to send something out. So this was kind of the happy middle when you consider those two kind of polar opposite outcomes. But yeah, I mean, Brogdon, when he first came over, like you said, I mean, I feel like I've covered probably 10 different Pacer teams in the last 3 years, because yep. When he originally signed, Victor Oladipo you know, was thought that maybe he would come back and look somewhat like Victor Oladipo. And that's how the point guard conversation kind of originated. You know, how are the two of them going to fit on the court? And he essentially said, my ideal position is point guard, but he can have the ball as much as he wants. And he knows that I'm going to get the ball to him in his spots. And as it turned out, they didn't actually play that much together. And when they did play together in the bubble, Victor wasn't himself anymore. He was a very different version of himself. So then the Bjorkren season happens. And I, in my opinion, Brogdon was way overtaxed that season. He and Sabonis were playing major minutes very early, as if game seven of the regular season was game seven of a playoff series. And his workload in terms of his touches, his time of possession was very heavy. And I think the last three seasons, you can really see that by the end of the year, he had kind of worn down. Like if you look, I mean, all three before they went to the bubble, if there wouldn't have been the 4 month hiatus, he most likely would not have been able to play in the playoffs because he had a torn quad tendon that kind of goes over your hip. I don't remember the specific terminology for it. But then last year going into the play-in tournament, he had a hamstring injury. He was able to play, but he missed several games there. And now this year, you know, he obviously sat at the end. I think some of that was to improve the Pacers draft positioning, but, you know, again, missed a lot of games and it wore on him as the season went on. So I think that's kind of a summary from the health standpoint. From a basketball standpoint, you could see different shifts between what some of the coaches were willing to do. I mean, I would say under Nate McMillan, Nate, I think most people know, is a lot more amenable to the mid-range in general. So the pick and roll between Sabonis and Brogdon in that 19-20 season, like that was almost a guaranteed bucket. Like when the two of them were in two-man game, you felt like, you know, you were wearing a warm blanket, like you felt safe when the two of them were out there. But by the next season, Nate Bjorkren was not so much, and teams really figured out, because the Pacers like led the league and movement on offense, that a good way to take or to get rid of that movement was to go under. So a lot of teams were going under against Malcolm Brogdon and really testing his ability to hit pull-up threes. And there wasn't as much room. It didn't seem to me like Bjorkren was as amenable to letting Sabonis automatically rescreen that and let Brogdon get into the mid-range area where he's a little bit more comfortable and hit that pull-up too. So that was causing him to have to drive a lot. And I mean, he did have a career season under Nate Bjorkren, but you could see the way that that impacted their offense a bit. Now this year under Rick Carlisle, he once again was tasked, like his time of possession and stuff was pretty close to what Luka's was in Dallas. So the three-point shooting did not rebound this year. I think some of that has to do with injuries, but I'm sure we'll get into more of that as we go on as well.
Yeah, the injuries is the big one, and that's, I think, why his cost, more than anything else, reached what it did here. At 40 of the last 50 games last year, you mentioned the tank implications there, probably extended that Achilles injury a little bit than it would have been if, you know, they had something to play for there. Injuries just about every year of his career since his rookie year, so you can almost assume that he's going to miss 10, 20, maybe more games going into a year. Celtics, fortunately, I think, well positioned, as we kicked around off the air, to you know, assume an injury, given that they have Marcus Smart, given that they have Derek White, other guys at that position. Like, it won't be devastating to see him step out of the lineup for, you know, a moderate amount of time during the year, unless it's a big injury that completely changes the course of his or the team's season. So I think it makes sense to assume the risk in that sense. They could eat the tax here, which is great. I don't know if anyone was certain that the Celtics were going to go this deep into the tax, pushing, I think, a $40 million bill at this point, which is just unprecedented for them. But they did it for this player. And I found the biggest intriguing point that multiple writers, Woj breaking it, made, is that this is the Celtics going after their true playmaking point guard. And, you know, that phrase has been tossed around. The Celtics has been tossed around Marcus Smart, whether he is that guy or isn't that guy. I think it's impossible to argue against anyone who said they needed to go and improve that spot after a postseason where their turnover rate went up in every round, where they couldn't hold on to the ball at all through their last three losses of the NBA Finals there. But I think everybody's looking at Brogdon and wondering, is he that guy? Because this is a player who, in Milwaukee at his best, it was off the ball, secondary drives, catch and shoot. He had that amazing 50-40-90 season everybody points to, which feels like forever ago now. Some similar stuff in Indiana, though he tried to make that transition to the point guard spot, it seemed there. But it still feels like they have two guys in Smart and Brogdon who have played more of their career off the ball than on the ball, you know, organizing things. They both have the skills that bode well to do that role in spots. But it doesn't feel like either of these guys are really the guy to have the ball all game and be running the offense.
Yeah, I mean, Brogdon's been their primary point guard for the Pacers for 3 years. I mean, I think a lot of people in Indiana think that that needed to shift. I would refer to him, or what I call him, as a 1.75. He can run offense, but I think he's better off playing off ball, being a slot driver, attacking closeouts, doing drive and kick in that type of way. I mean, I think that Boston will be able to use him in pick and roll. His pick and roll efficiency is very good, in part because his turnover rate is so very, very low. If you were to look that up on Synergy, I think there's like 17 players in the NBA who had a turnover frequency in the pick and roll below 10%. And he's one.
He had
them.
A great year even last year, it looked like, in that role. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's one of them. But the thing that I would describe is, it's kind of like when you get glasses for the first time, when Tyrese Halliburton came over, and it's like, oh, that's how the offense was supposed to look. So like Brogdon can read the defense and find the open man. He's not going to shift tertiary defenders for you. Like Tyrese is going to actually shift taggers, shift guys at the nail, and make people more open. I don't really think that's something Malcolm Brogdon does. He can hit pause. He has a nice change of speed, a hesitation at times. He can get into offense, but I've noticed over the last 2 years, because like I said, the first year, it was like he and Sabonis were money. The next year, team started really going under, and that bothered him. This year, part of the reason the Pacers were struggling in clutch time a lot was they would get into fourth quarters, and like one of three things would happen. Teams would either really start full court pressing them, like they were in New York, and Tom Thibodeau unleashed Alec Burks against Malcolm Brogdon, pressured him 94 feet, and Brogdon really doesn't have the burst handle combination to handle that and get into offense very well. Or they would start blitzing him. And in theory, you would think, well, that's going to be really beneficial because Sabonis is so good on the short roll. But like, you could point to game after game after game where he would be getting blitzed and they had like a strange allergy to being able to get the ball to the middle of the floor. His pass accuracy could be a little bit better out to 3-point shooters, I think, at times. And like, if he's going to throw a skip pass, sometimes that guy's going to have to, you know, shift over and get out of his shooting pocket and then get back into it. I think that's a little bit of a thing as well. But the main thing that I think stands out is a weakness for Brogdon when he's running pick and roll. And if people want to go look at this, I would very much recommend that you watch the game that they played in Denver against Denver, because they used Austin Rivers to weak him. So I'm talking about a middle pick and roll. They're weaking Brogdon to his left, because if you watch Malcolm Brogdon enough in the pick and roll, if he goes right, he will generally shoot. If he goes left, he's almost exclusively going to drive. He's not comfortable going left as a shooter. So teams will either weak him and force him to do that and have him drive into a crowd, or they'll go under. And then he's just not as good of a shooter off the dribble as he is in catch and shoot situations. So that stands out. And then also, just like, if he's in a top isolation situation, he really can't get to his shot without a screen. He needs that there. So he's not going to get to an off the dribble shot to create separation for himself. He almost exclusively drives. So people will load up on that as well if he's going to be your primary. You know, maybe not as big of a deal if you're still going to be relying on Tatum to do a lot of that type of stuff, and then you are comfortable with Brogdon playing off the ball and getting that type of, you know, driving kick action like I referenced. But to me, it still kind of feels like, let me be careful here, because I don't want the Boston faithful to get mad at me. If you're Brad Stevens, you make this trade every single time. Like, there's no questioning to me that you trade for Malcolm Brogdon. But it still kind of feels to me that Brogdon doesn't necessarily solve their core issues, which is like, Tatum's going to have to get better at drawing fouls around the basket. His playmaking, while it did make strides, is still going to have to get a little bit better, because I still think you're going to need him to create the initial advantage. And then, you know, Jaylen Brown's handles is also going to have to improve. This relieves some of that, but I don't think it completely fixes it.
Yeah, it's a release valve. And that's the point. Like, this is why I thought the playmaking need was overrated here, is because it's going to be Tatum at the end of the day, no matter what, with the ball in his hands, running the offense, whatever you want to call him, point guard, point forward, whatever those roles shake out to be. Tatum's going to have the ball in his hands more than anyone else throughout the course of a game. It almost felt like spacing was the bigger need for him when Grant Williams declined as the postseason went on and some of their shooting stagnated. You talk about Brogdon being an effective off-ball guy, and especially at times in his career, an elite, catch and shoot guy. He brings multiple layers of offense, it seems like, that really helped him at the spot. But I mean, like you said, the cost is obvious. You're going to make this deal 100 out of 100 times just to get a player who consolidates your roster a little bit, gives you another tool, gives you depth, gives you someone who can step into Smart's role if he's hurt, or spell Tatum for a game if he needs a night off. There's a million different reasons you would do this, but I just find that characterization that they needed a playmaking point guard, right? You know, just to toss the phrase around that's been used a million different ways, it felt like that was really a need. And Brad Stevens said that was a need after the season went on, so more playmaking. And I just wonder, when you look at him as a player, the ways in which he's going to be able to relieve that and what that means for Marcus Smart, because I feel like that, more than anything else, could be the only downside of this, unless he gets hurt. It is them kind of butting heads a little bit over that spot, if you want to call it the point guard position, the starting role, whatever it is, these two guys who I think both take pride in that role, both want that role on a team, but there's really only one spot in the starting lineup or on the floor in crunch time. These guys probably could play together in crunch time, but who knows how that shakes out. And that's the only pause I have about this move, is just what it means for Marcus Smart, how he receives it, and where Brogdon kind of fits in, because it feels like you almost have to start Smart and continue to play him in that role to assure him that that is still his role here and he's not being demoted by this move.
Yeah, because I mean, I did see Marcus's quotes where he essentially said, you know, we had a point guard in the past, and we just got to the NBA Finals with me. So that leads me to think that that's still pretty important to him, just as, you know, yeah, what I had mentioned with Brogdon before. Now, Brogdon did, I read Jared Weiss's article. It sounds like he's pretty amenable to doing what needs to be done, that he wants to compete. But, you know, he also had the opportunity to compete with Milwaukee, and he chose to go to Indiana because he wanted to show he was a point guard. Now, maybe after going through, you know, seeing what the Pacers were doing with their mini rebuild, maybe he, you know, really missed being able to go out there and actually compete for games and have them matter. So it's possible that he's changed his mind on that. And also going through the Achilles injury, it's possible that maybe after dealing with that and having to, that taking as long as it did to rehab that and be able to be back out on the court, that he's realized that doing, you know, a little bit less might actually be better for his longevity. I do wonder too, like, if we just want to dive into the shooting a little bit, because he didn't shoot the ball well off the catch or off the dribble this year. I think some of that can be attributed to the Achilles and the other injuries that he had, but I do think it will help him to do more off the catch. Because if you look at that season when he was 50, 40, 90 in Milwaukee, I have the numbers here, 81% of his threes that year were wide open and 73% were off the catch.
The Giannis effect.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, he's playing off of Giannis's interior gravity. So then when he comes over to the Pacers, you know, that those numbers quickly shifted. Like, under Nate McMillan, 65% of his threes were off the dribble. Under Nate Bjorken, 53%, and under Rick Carlisle, 50%. So he's having to do a lot more in that situation. And like I said, sometimes it has to do with his gather. If he has to go left, he's just not going to be as good of a shooter. I've written a longer article about that. But if you can get him more over there, and I think part of the problem too, when he came back, like, he was basically a paint missile in those 8 games when he came back with Tyrese. Like, it felt very evident to me that he was trying to show, like, I don't know if he thought he was going to be traded, but that he wanted to show he was healthy. He averaged like over 22 drives per game. He was like 5th in the league and drawing free throws out of those drives as well. But there were times where he was turning down shots to drive. So I don't know if missing the shots or how he was feeling was impacting that. But like, just as an example, they were in Washington and he was just like killing everybody on slot drives, just going past, going past, going past. Kispert, Denny, it didn't matter. Denny's a good isolation defender. Denny like bounces off of him. He has like 6 feet of space to shoot, and instead of shooting, he drives back into him again. So the shooting is somewhat of an interesting topic. I mean, if he can, like I said, if he can get back to playing off of Tatum's gravity and some of those, you know, little things that we talked about, that Brown and Tatum strides they still need to make, if Brown can play with his eyes up more because his handle gets better, and he can find Brogdon on target, then, you know, I think that it's possible that he can get those numbers back closer to what he was doing when he was playing in Milwaukee.
Yeah, and the Celtics do stagger their lineups pretty well. So even if he is coming off the bench, he'll have opportunities to play with Rob, hopefully, and roll there with him. That would be really exciting to watch. He'll have the ball in his hands more in those lineups, I think. And you probably want to keep that starting five if you're the Celtics together from last year. Smart, Brown, Tatum, Horford, Rob. Defensively, that unit was just dynamite. And Brogdon, I think the plus on top of everything else we've talked about is that he can fit this defensive scheme a little bit, switch some, I'd imagine, at his size. And, you know, I think he is a better off-ball defender, you've talked about, than point of attack guy. But Smart, I think overall, being able to switch 1 through 5 just has the advantage and versatility over him as a whole, which, you know, I don't think a lot of guards in general are going to be able to compete with the versatility and, you know, defensive player of the year pedigree and just everything that Smart brings to that side of the floor. So I think that is another feather in Smart's cap when it comes to the starting lineup decision that they're going to have to make between these two. Smart, underrated passer. I want you to get into Brogdon's defense, but also just the passing and how these two compare as passers. Because I know the ball control didn't pan out great for Smart down the stretch, but just watching him, he really is a great passer. The problem is that he just doesn't have the scoring threat, the scoring abilities to kind of set up his passing that Brogdon probably does. So I think Brogdon's ability to be a threat, off the dribble, getting to the rim, the different things he does as a scorer make him a better passer possibly. But just as a pure passer, I love what Smart brings to the table. It's a tough decision between these two. It really is.
Defensively, yeah, what you bring up is pretty accurate. I mean, there was reasons why, just as an example that I'm sure Celtic fans will be familiar with, even though Kemba Walker was looking cooked, there's a very specific reason why they're matching up and Brogdon is defending Evan Fournier and not Kemba Walker. They're putting Duarte on Kemba and having him pressure him and letting Karis guard RJ Barrett. You do not want Malcolm Brogdon guarding speedy guards in any form, whether he's switching onto them or he's trailing over in a drop coverage. That's not something that you really want to have happen. He's much better defending against wings. You'd want to shift him over. So in that sense, if he is playing minutes potentially with Marcus, that will be something that Brogdon hasn't had. The Pacers have not had a point of attack defender that's made it super viable for him not to have to do that. I mean, Duarte tried to do it. There was other times where, even sometimes they'd be playing Jamal Murray or they'd be playing Devin Booker and they'd tried to have TJ Warren do it so that Malcolm wouldn't have to. But that would be beneficial for him because he can come out, his defensive positioning just isn't great. He comes out flat footed and then he's just not quick enough. From a playmaking standpoint, Brogdon isn't somebody, they did play very fast under Nate Bjorkren. They were top 10 in pace as well as transition frequency. But he's somebody who wants to play much more methodical. So given that the Celtics ranked, 27th in transition offense and efficiency, their turnover rate was, absurd. I think they were, 24th in turnover rate in transition. The way that Brogdon secures the ball and can also get up the court, one of his favorite things, like I said, he's not Tyrese and that he's going to immediately look to get downhill and get into stuff. But he's very good at hitting pause and doing, a fake pistol and then getting right to the rim. So in the sense that I think he can quell some of what can be overzealous for the Celtics in transition at times, I think that will be a benefit to him having the ball in his hands right there over Marcus in that type of a situation as far as a passer.
Yeah, and in crunch time, slowing things down. I mean, that's something he talked about as well in some of his early comments coming over the Celtics here and just how he sort of projects his role here. That'll be a benefit, I think, if he can do that as well. I wonder some of the things you talk about with Brogdon. Smart's going to be a big part of this puzzle no matter what. They're both going to be out there in crunch time more often than not, I'd imagine. They're both going to have huge roles on this team. But I do wonder what it means for Derek White, because a lot of the stuff we talk about Brogdon being great at here is stuff that I think the Celtics acquired Derek White looking for initially. But you talk about catch and shoot, just nothing from him there. Really struggled, I think, to create because he didn't have the ball in his hands a lot and really couldn't be a threat to score out of those catch opportunities. A little secondary dribble action that was helpful at times. And overall, I don't think it went how he wanted it to. I don't think it went how the Celtics expected it to for him out there. So he's going to be the guy more than anyone else, it seems like, takes a back seat out of this. But I almost wonder if he'll be on the roster at all. Some other team values him. If they're able to maybe swap him out in a bigger deal, a salary for a depth big or a wing, there's still a few needs that you could probably swap White out. Because as it stands, Smart, Brogdon probably fill out most of the minutes at that main guard spot, I'd assume. And anything else, White's going to be off the ball on this roster, which I still look at and say that's not his best position to succeed. So I almost wonder if White has any role on this team. He obviously has a role, but it's going to be much smaller than it even was last year. And by the end of the finals, he really wasn't even playable. It's just so disappointing how that trade went because they gave up a lot and he really didn't solve all that much. He was helpful. I think all the little things he did made him viable despite his immense shooting and scoring ish. Man, this almost feels like a move to fix what didn't go right with the White trade.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would probably be somewhat playoff series to playoff series. I mean, Malcolm Brogdon's a better player than Derek White. I think he's a more complete player than Derek White. But when they're playing the Miami Heat and you can have Derek White doing lock and trail defense against their various shooters, and then you can have, potentially Robert Williams up at the level and then also have Jaylen Brown stunning over, that made a pretty big difference at cutting off what the Heat like to do with release valves and with their movement shooters. I don't think Brogdon's going to be as strong in lock and trail defense as what you could do throwing Derek White out there in those types of situations.
He became a fun screen and roller in that series too, which was effective.
Yeah. Yeah. That I don't necessarily think that that's going to be Brogdon's strength, but In terms of him being somewhat respectable, I mean, I think most teams, his release is a little bit slower, but you are going to play him closer. Even when he isn't shooting the ball, you're not going to have a defender sagging off of him as much as you're going to with Derek White, just right off the bat. So I think that that's just an automatic upgrade. And I do also think that Brogdon's better at keeping a live dribble in tight spaces. So like if you get into the paint and his initial drive is cut off, he can still, you know, continue to probe or, you know, have a really good long last step to still get to the rim in a way that Derek White's probably going to get somewhat stranded or have to immediately kick out.
Yeah. So that's where the Celtics stand out of this trade. Hard to not like the move. There's so much upside here and the downsides aren't that pronounced, and again they seem like a team that's pretty well equipped to deal with an injury he goes through or, you know, any other issues that they might have here on that front. So from the Pacers perspective, we've talked about Nesmith a little bit at length here on the Celtics side, the hope he had left. We actually kicked around what role he might have on the roster and what chances he had to emerge right after the Danilo Gallinari signing went through, but this happened right after. Now he's off to Indiana. I think everybody's happy about that. He can play a lot more side, have a lot more room to take threes, to just get extended minutes, because more than anything through 2 years here, there was just not consistent opportunity for him on the Celtics team. 1-2 3-point attempts were making or breaking his performance, and he just really went into a hole that got deeper and deeper and deeper through two seasons. And again, I think a lot of people, draft evaluators out of that class, the consensus was this was one of the best shooters in that 2020 class. But he really only had that one stretch to close the 2021 regular season where he shot 40% from deep, you know, some good action out of the corners. Defensively, he made a quick appearance in that Miami series, and it looked like he had kind of figured some things out on that end, because that was his big weakness coming into the league. I think this team's scheme, all the switching, really made it difficult for him in year two especially. Didn't have the trust of Stevens, didn't have the trust of Udoka. So I don't think there's a ton of hope here for him, but he is going to a situation where he can at least play, which is a good thing for a player that early in his career.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Pacers, they've kind of made it a practice of theirs to take on players that are unloved in situations, and a lot of times that has panned out. Like, you can look at Victor and Sabonis, or you can look more recently at an example that I think would be clearer to Aaron Nesmith's journey of Jalen Smith. You know, Jalen wasn't going to have an opportunity to play a lot of minutes for the Phoenix Suns when they're a contender, but they trade for him at the deadline. It wasn't certain they were going to be able to re-sign him, and he popped for them. He did some nice things enough that they wanted to re-sign him and keep him for another 2 or 3 years potentially and see what else he can do. I think that's probably what they're hoping with Aaron Nesmith. I mean, it's not necessarily the cleanest path, because when you look at their roster right now, it's like a ton of guys who are 6'6" and under who are mainly spot-up shooters or a bunch of centers. So I'm not exactly sure where his playing time is going to shake out, because I would imagine that they're probably planning on starting Tyrese and potentially Buddy if he's still on the roster, and Mathurin as well, since they just, you know, use their number 6 pick on Benedict Mathurin. But I think that they will give him a chance. I think he will have an opportunity to get minutes. And for me, like, I don't think it was all necessarily, I understand from Ime Udoka's perspective after I watched more of him why he wasn't getting regular minutes, if I'm being honest. It's not
his
just that
misses were so bad. Yeah, and yeah, other stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, other stuff. Like, I tried to look for games when he was playing in non-garbage time to see what was going on. And, you know, he is a hop-catch shooter. And I feel like there's times where, you know, Tatum would get into the paint and it would take him too long to find the passing window. So that was making things a little bit harder on Tatum, where he's not necessarily making himself visible. And then once he was, he's having to hop into that shot. And I think that alters his release a little bit. He needs to be in rhythm in order to make those shots. So if he's not moving into the shot correctly, that impacts him. And then, you know, what you said defensively, like that Heat series, I watched that game and, you know, he had that one incredible play where he stopped that 1-on-4 fast break. And you're like, wow, this dude is amazing. And then 2 or 3 plays later, it's like, wow, what is this dude doing? Like, he's in crash mode and he's everywhere. And he's just getting fouls for no apparent reason. And you kind of want him to tame some of that energy down a little bit. And it seems like he can get lost in certain circumstances. But, you know, given that if the Pacers think he can be a wing, they basically don't have any wings. So it won't hurt them to give him more reps. I do question, you know, a little bit sometimes if he can attack closeouts, but I worry about his left hand a little bit. It feels like when he gets into the paint that way, he always wants to inside hand layups with his right, and that's not super successful for him. Or he has to, you know, use a fake over his shoulder and try to get back because he can't leverage his shoulder into a floater. But, you know, maybe that's stuff that the Pacers development staff can work with him on. I think that the main impetus for this was that, you know, you can take a chance on Aaron Nesmith. They obviously wanted the pick. And I think that based on stuff that's getting reported about Ayton, they really wanted that cap space as well. So if they get Ayton and they have the pick, they're probably going to be happy whether Nesmith actually pops or not.
Yeah. So I do want to get on to Ayton because he's sitting out there and it doesn't really seem to be much buzz about when he's going to make that move and how he might connect to a Kevin Durant deal, which does seem to be losing momentum at this point. So maybe that is the direction he goes. Indiana, sign an offer sheet, head over there. I doubt the Suns would match it, even if they want to maintain him as an asset. Like, they just don't seemingly want to carry that contract. And it doesn't seem like anyone's thrilled to give him that deal out there, but Indiana does have that cap space now. I think it makes some sense to acquire a player of that caliber in free agency if you can as the Pacers, because, you know, how many opportunities do you get to do that as Indiana? I do wonder, though, how you just project him fitting on this team if they do ultimately land Ayton, though.
Yeah, so I'm actually in that process. I mean, I think in a lot of ways he's going to fit perfectly with Tyrese Haliburton if he's amenable to continue doing what he's doing in Phoenix, which at times it seems like he's not. I mean, he's made reference in the past about wanting to play the four and do other things that it's almost like a curse that he has, that the things that he's good at, he doesn't really seem to enjoy. And the things that he wants to do aren't necessarily things that he should be doing. But like, just as an example, Miles Turner, I think this year on screen, on, if you look at Synergy, after setting a screen, he rolled on 43% of his screens. The rest of the time he was popping. So that is, I think, either the highest or the second highest that he's ever rolled to the rim. Ayton is closer to 80%. So for, if you're a guy like Tyrese Haliburton who doesn't get to the rim a lot, he more relies on his floater, throwing lobs to keep that off balance, and his skip pass, having a rim roller is pretty important to you, I think. Having somebody that can put rim pressure there. Ayton's one of the best finishers in the league. And also there are times where, you know, teams, opponents will switch or they'll just flat out, you know, change matchups. Like Denver will put Aaron Gordon on Tyrese Haliburton and put, you know, Monte Morris on one of their wings because length will bother him in certain circumstances. So if you have a big, which they don't currently have, that you can throw the ball into down low and can seal a small in front of the basket and actually do something there as Ayton can, I think that that will make a big difference for Tyrese as well. So just right off the bat, and they also run a lot of things that are very similar to what Phoenix already does that I can see that would work pretty easily. And so like, that's not really stuff that applies to Miles Turner. Like, he sometimes can do something against the switch, but, you know, he also can have pound dribbles that go to nowhere, or like it can be a little bit awkward, or he's not a rim roller. Like I said, he's more somebody that's going to pop. So I do question that fit a little bit. And Ayton's younger, so they do have some similar weaknesses. I don't think they're very similar players. I mean, Ayton has some feel issues. He doesn't do a lot of self-creation. Some of that also applies to Miles, but Ayton is younger, so you have more time to bank on him maybe working on his field than, you know, year 7 or 8 of Miles Turner, and hoping that that still turns the corner when you're not guaranteed that it will. So I don't know that I'm super comfortable with paying DeAndre Ayton a max contract at $30 million.
Given that's what I was going to get to. Yeah.
Given that, like, yeah, I think about 80% of his twos were assisted last year. He just doesn't do a lot in the self-creation realm that you can point to with other centers who are on max level deals, or like with a Rudy Gobert where the defensive impact is just so undeniable that you're willing to do it, even though that isn't there. But, you know, in the case with the Pacers, maybe if he comes to a team where there's not as much pressure to be a playoff team or a contender, and he's going to be, you know, a number one, number two option, he can workshop some of that, and you're okay if he makes mistakes. You're okay if he turns it over trying to put together, you know, a 2 or 3 dribble move to get to the basket. Because, I mean, you'll see on his tape that a lot of times, like, his hook shot is, like, basically unstoppable. The numbers on that are crazy. But a smart defender like, you know, Draymond Green is going to sit on his hip because he almost always turns to the right. And then his counter move is to spin back to the left and hit his turnaround. So he doesn't really want to dribble the ball with his left. So if I were them, I would sit on it, prevent the hook shot, and then shade him to his left and force him to drive. Come up to his right foot and force him to put the ball on it, on the floor with his left. Those are stuff, that's the type of stuff he's going to have to work on. But when you're, like I said, when you're playing for the Pacers, maybe you're okay. Like, if he does turn it over trying to drive to his left, because, you know, little baby steps of progress that the Phoenix Suns are probably like, look, look, dude, we don't need you doing that. We just want you to set screens and roll the basket and be a release valve for Chris Paul, you know? So the environment's a little bit different. And then maybe he grows into that $30 million a little bit more than what he would with Phoenix.
Yeah, we'll see. That's a tough contract, especially when you haven't paid Halliburton yet. So that's going to be another, you know, max level deal, you'd imagine, when that day comes. And, you know, there is a limit to what Indiana wants to spend ultimately. And then you got to figure out what you're doing with Turner, which is, we're 3 years into that at this point. Effectively, we're kicking around. Is it going to be Sabonis? It's going to be Turner. And it turns out if they go with Ayton, it's neither. And this wasn't a great return for Brogdon. I can't even imagine what the return is going to be for Turner if it reaches the lowest level of value for him in the end. It might even just be a sign and trade kickout and sending him back to Phoenix or whatever bigger deal develops here. It almost feels like a six-way trade is going to develop that just solves all the issues of the league right now.
Yeah, the Miles Turner trade value thing is always a mystery, because with the exception of when the Pacers tried to get Gordon Hayward, I just talked about this with somebody the
other day. The Celtics didn't even want to take him.
Well, yeah, I mean, with the exception of that, like, Miles has been on the trade block almost every year since, I think, 2017-18, or has been mentioned in rumors. I don't know exactly which way that's always originating from, but I have never once heard what an offer has been. Never. Like, I've never seen somebody report that, so... In that sense, like, whatever the Pacers get, you're probably just going to be like, okay, because, I mean, I have nothing to compare it to. You're not going to be able to say, oh, you waited too long, because we don't know what his value would have been 2 or 3 years ago. I imagine now that he's come off of 2 seasons where he hasn't finished the season and has had various, you know, it was turf toe last year. This year it was a stress reaction, not a fracture, but a reaction that kept him out.
That was a killer.
That will be, you know, that might cause teams to lowball them, I'm sure. I'm wondering about what his health situation is. I mean, he said now that he is fully healthy and he's ready to play. But, you know, I think that the one risk that the Pacers have, on the one hand, you know, if they don't get something done with Ayton, there's the chance that they could bring Miles back. He'll get to play solo five. He'll get to play with Tyrese. I think there is a Tyrese effect with bigs and improving that 2-point percentage. So maybe you can bank on that, but it's not guaranteed. If it doesn't happen, teams are going to know. Like, there's always been something holding that, you know, people will bring up that's holding Miles back. Oh, it's Nate McMillan. Oh, it's Sabonis. Oh, it's Malcolm Brogdon. Or, oh, it's this. Like, if all of those caveats are gone and it doesn't change, then every other opponent's going to know too. Every other rival team's going to know it didn't change. So, like, if you're a team like Dallas, like, I know that they already have Christian Wood and they signed JaVale McGee, but, like, if you're a team like Dallas and you're thinking, well, we have Luka Doncic and you're going to get to play the five here, it'll be different. And you've seen with the Pacers and Tyrese that it isn't, you know, that could hurt the Pacers' negotiating standing as well.
Yeah, and there's a lot to like about his game, but it hasn't rounded out there. And if no one around the league projects that it would round out in their situations and they don't want to extend themselves a little bit, I think the price point has made it tough too there with his salary where it is. It doesn't make it a flyer. You're suddenly making him a significant percentage of your cap, and all of a sudden he needs to be a sizable part of your team at that point. And even a team like the Celtics that effectively could have just taken him for, you know, facilitating that Hayward trade, they didn't even want to do that just because it didn't seem like they wanted to invest in him or make him someone that they relied upon. And I like different things that he does, but it just doesn't seem to come together into a player that really impacts the game, you know, beyond the stat sheet or beyond some flashy moments here or there. So it's too bad. Maybe he was hurt by playing along Sabonis for all those years, for being cast where he was, and maybe just stagnated as a player because of that. But he was never really able to get out of where he started. Like, I really don't feel like he's even grown all that much over the years. Like, he just kind of is who he is.
I mean, you can see little things in flashes. I did think this year, like at the beginning of the year, he was shooting the three a little bit better, and you would actually see him drawing some closeouts and, you know, attacking a closeout, putting together some dribble moves where he was driving and actually getting to the rim some. I thought that was a difference for him. I think over the years defensively, he's shown little things where, you know, whether it's his hand activity or his recognition of where he needs to be in drop coverage, or maybe, you know, being able to hang a little bit, not in all situations on switches, but in some. Against, you know, maybe threes or bigger wings where he can hold up and defend on the perimeter a little bit, that type of stuff. But for me, it always goes back to, you know, he wants to play the five, but he rarely gets defended by fives. So you have to find a situation where that's actually going to happen, because even before Sabonis was a starter, I mean, he had time. He was the starting five for, you know, two years where Sabonis was still coming off the bench. Thad's playing with him, and you would go to Philadelphia or you'd go to Utah and Joel Embiid would guard Thad, not Miles, or Rudy Gobert would guard Thad, not Miles. So he was never really getting an opportunity to pull people into space and get the matchup that he really needed. So there's that. And then also, he's just not great at finding his own usage. I think a lot of it is still just his game processing. Like what I mentioned earlier about Ayton, if Ayton gets a switch, Like, I know that he needed to play with more force a lot of the time in that Mavericks series, and that's certainly a criticism of him that is valid. But if he gets a switch on a pick and roll, he's immediately going to dive into the front of the rim. Now, he may be do something more with finesse where you would want power, but he's going to recognize it and do it. Like, there was possessions during the COVID Pacer time where, you know, it's G League players and he and Sabonis playing, and he gets a switch out of, like, they run pick and rolls on both sides. He has a switch and he literally points for them to reverse the ball the other way because that is the play, but he doesn't recognize that he has the switch and he needs to use a swim move and do something about it. Or then there'll be other times where, you know, he might just dive to the block when Ayton's guarding him and clog a driving lane. So there are certain times where just spatially knowing where to go after he makes a pass or after he sets a screen just isn't still a strength of his. If he could ever put all of that together and do it consistently, I think that you would see, you know, a pretty good player on the offensive end of the floor. And to all of his credit, on, you know, he was a high efficiency, low usage player this year for most of the season. I think the ways that Rick Carlisle used him made sense. It's just that we've never actually seen him do things like we saw Sabonis do. Miles has never really been a player where, you know, you see the evolution of a star where it's, you know, guy starts to score 20 a game and then he draws double coverage and he learns to pass out of that. That's Sabonis. And then from there, the next step is to show that you can still score even if you draw a double team. Sabonis could do that sometimes, not all the time. Miles has never got to level two. He doesn't often get into games where teams react to him and defend him in a different way. A lot of times that's what we're going to live with. Like, you know, if you make a three and your starting five beats us on threes from the perimeter, then, you know, we guess he does. Or, you know, if you're going to post us, we're not going to double. You know, that type of stuff. So if he starts doing it more consistently, he is going to see different coverage, and I don't know what that looks like yet.
Would be funny for Indiana if they do just go the road of signing Ayton, no sign and trade, just use that cap space, ending up with Jalen Smith, Ayton, and Turner, and then just figuring it out from there and leaving Phoenix with nothing effectively inside. I get the argument that there hasn't really been a team that's invested that much money, that percentage of their cap in a center and had championship level success. Philadelphia is probably the high end of it, and even probably to no fault of Embiid, they've been limited to the second round effectively building the roster the way they have there. So I don't know if you have much choice if you're Indiana on who you want to use your cap space on, and maybe this elite young center who, again, is younger than Turner and has this upside would be the ideal way to use it. But there is going to be some risk in that, I think, especially with some of the concerns he has. You're probably just taking back very little to nothing for Turner at that point, or just throwing him in the deal to dump the salary, because, you know, I don't think Indiana's going to carry this much salary. You got Buddy Hield and all of these different salaries on the roster now. Even TJ McConnell's pretty high for not doing all that much last year with his injury. But the young portion of this roster, this is the summer league team that you want to follow. I mean, multiple young players, guys who are going to play for this team, a top-end pick in Benedict Mathurin. This is going to be one of the teams to watch in Vegas this week, and I'm heading out there tomorrow. I'll definitely try to catch a Pacers game. Benedict, you had that big four at the top of this class who got a ton of love. All the conversation was about them going in, and this seemed to be the next guy up, and he certainly goes five right after them there, or number six, rather. What have you seen in his game? What do you think the fit's going to be for him in Indiana right away? Because this just doesn't seem to be a guy that's been talked about all that much out of this class.
Yeah, so I was pretty convinced. I mean, what you say about the summer league team, I think is true. I mean, there's going to be like seven guys between their rookies from last year and this year that, you know, is going to comprise a lot of the Pacers roster from next season. And they just have a lot of shooting, a lot of athleticism. So I think you're going to see a lot of spacing and up and down play out of that particular group. But with Mathurin, when the way that we constructed and did our draft coverage at Indy Corner is we watched like a handful of games and then picked like a stock up, stock down. When I watched the first game of him, I was pretty convinced that that's who the Pacers would take. Just watching the way that Arizona ran offense, Tommy Lloyd became Arizona's head coach, who was previously, you know, at Gonzaga as an assistant. And they run a very read-based offense, and then certain actions that they used are identical to things that Rick Carlisle runs. So I was very convinced that you didn't have to use much imagination. They had talked about how they were going to bring guys in for workouts and watch film with them and ask them how they would fit the Pacers. And I was like, this is going to be the easiest job that Benedict Mathurin's ever had, because he's just going to be like, I'll just run that play. But yeah, so between he and Tyrese, I think that the fit's definitely going to be there, because if you look at the numbers between Brogdon and Tyrese and Buddy and Tyrese, the Pacers got outscored by like 17 points per 100 in those eight games when Brogdon played, and that deserves some context. But There's evidence that playing him next to a guy like Buddy, who's more of an off-ball mover, off-ball shooter, can do some things in terms of secondary skills, was a better overall fit. And, you know, that's kind of like Mathurin to a degree is like Buddy just with tons of athleticism. They want to play faster, and Mathurin really unlocks his athleticism in the open floor. So that's never really been a feature of Rick's teams over like the last 7 years. But I think if you give him the horses, and it very much feels to me that they're all in on this based on who they drafted and who else is on the roster, that, you know, they really want to be able to play in transition more often. That's definitely something Tyrese wants to do. If you watch a Pacer game, you're going to see him really clapping for the ball on inbounds and wanting to get it up and immediately get into double drags or get into, you know, some type of secondary offense right away. So, and Mathurin is just a really good cutter. So between that and pairing that with Tyrese's eye manipulation, I think that the two of them will play off each other really well. I buy into his shooting. It went down during his sophomore season, but when you look at the synergy numbers, I think that there's just some noise. He missed some, he shot better, I believe, on contested than uncontested threes. So if he starts hitting the wide open ones, you know, I think he's fine, especially given how many tough ones he was taking off movement.
This could be an offense right away next year. I mean, they're young, so it's going to be a little erratic probably and go up and down game to game. But you even saw late last year, this team, Celtics game in particular, where they knocked off the Celtics, where they were on that great run. This is just an offense that could explode on any given night. All the shooting, the playmaking through Halliburton, you add Ayton to that on top of it all. This team could already look a little dangerous next year. Now, it's going to be about building consistency, the defense. You still wonder when that will take shape around all these young, more offensively oriented players here. But the way this has turned around pretty quickly, I mean, we just started talking about rebuild at some point last year, right? And to already have this much young talent, to already be potentially landing a max free agent, and to have a centerpiece in Halliburton, I mean, it's unbelievable how this came together. And that really was the move, right, that got all this going. That Halliburton trade came out of nowhere. It's still shocking that the Kings did it. You had to take back that horrible Hield contract. I don't know what they're going to do with that, but you do that 10 times out of 10, and it feels like they've already won that trade and are well on their way to becoming a pretty good team here.
Yeah, I mean, and by the end of the year, to be completely fair, like, I felt pretty good about Buddy by the end of the season. I mean, he played better for the Pacers than he did for the Kings. He got to the rim more often. He passed. His assist rate went up. I mean, I think it helped him because the Pacers did have other shooters. He got to play adjacent. He was in the starting lineup. He had the greenest green light possible. And there was just a lot of space. If Tyrese got a switch, they would throw it to Buddy at the slot. He could attack into it. He was a willing passer. I mean, in the back of my mind, I tend to think that, you know, when you feel good about Buddy Hield, it's probably the time to trade Buddy Hield. But by the end of the season, I'd be okay if he was still on the roster next year. I know that he and Tyrese are very close. They have a degree of chemistry there. But like you said, the contract's not great. It's clearly a reason that Sacramento was willing to include him in that type of a deal. But yeah, I mean, I still think that they're in a rebuilding state. I think that's why they made the type of trade that they did with Malcolm. I don't think that they're in a rush to skip steps. And I don't think that signing Ayton necessarily would be skipping steps either. I mean, I think that they realize that it's going to be a process. And for Tyrese, you know, I think that there's somewhat of a give and take. I think that surrounding him with shooting and stuff is good because he can be very deferential. After that trade deadline, he only had 3 games where he led the Pacers in field goal attempts. And that was with a lot of guys who, you know, were trying to prove themselves in the league and were kind of G League players. So he needs to show that he's going to be able to increase that usage. And in part, that's why you kind of move on from Brogdon, because he only had a 16% usage in the minutes when he played with Brogdon. It was 20 without Brogdon. And that's still, like, I think there was like 39 players last year who averaged over 5 minutes of time of possession. And the only person with a lower usage rate than Tyrese was Kyle Lowry. So he needs to show that, you know, he realizes how good he is. I think that's the way that I would term it. Some of it is his ability to actually get into the rim against the switch and what he's going to do about it. And that game you referenced against Boston was an important stride for him, because he did have some switches against Al Horford where Al surged out against him and he used that low gather and got into the paint and drew contact. That's an important step for him to be, you know, the centerpiece and for you to buy into him being like a number one option. I don't think that I've completely seen all of that yet. I love everything that he does. I think that he plays a very inclusive style of basketball where his teammates want to play for him. But I also don't need you to get into overtime against OKC and have Lance Stephenson go 0-4 where you're passing him the ball instead of yourself. So, I mean,
ideally, Stevenson's not going to be on this roster next year.
Well, don't tell Pacer fans that. They'll get angry.
Oh, wow. What a year. What a couple of years it's been for the Indiana Pacers here. And TJ Warren takes off, which is probably a little bit of bummer for Pacers fans too, because he was so great in the bubble there, and then he just never played again. And it, you know, there was a little while there where it looked like it was inevitable that he was going to re-sign here, and he was comfortable in Indiana, and there wasn't really a big urgency to leave, but they probably just didn't want to pay him in the end, and no one really did, and he just ends up taking a flyer with the Nets. So that was kind of a bummer, I'd imagine, for, you know, Pacers fans looking at how it went with him over the last 3 years here.
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird saga, if we're being honest. I don't know how closely people followed it, but, you know, he had tweeted last summer that he had played basketball and had fun, and shortly thereafter, he had been kind of ruled out indefinitely from training camp. The Pacers termed it as he was healing more slowly than expected, and then they had said at Media Day that the hope was that he would be out weeks, not months. And then little by little, more and more months.
It's like a Zion North.
it was very similar. Like little by little, more time went past, and it was definitely becoming months. And, you know, there was never any timetable for return. He would get scans. They would be favorable. There was never any timetable for return until the end of the season. Yeah. Until the end of the season, it became kind of obvious that, you know, there's no real point and no incentive for him as a free agent to come back at this point, when they're kind of trying to improve their draft positioning a little bit. And then, you know, he had kind of just disappeared and gone back to home to Raleigh to continue rehabbing, even though he had been fully cleared. So by the time the season was over, there was no part of me that expected that he would be back on the team next year. Now, if you had asked me that 2 years ago, I probably would have had a different opinion, but I didn't expect, you know, the Pacers kind of just had to turn the lights off on the core that they had because they were never healthy at the same time. So I'm not exactly surprised that, you know, Brogdon is now on a different team. TJ Warren is on a different team, and it's entirely possible, you know, especially if Miles doesn't want to sign an extension, that he will be on a different team as well.
Yeah, Warren, Brogdon, Sabonis, Turner, Oladipo, that whole core, it's gone. Didn't go as far as they wanted it to, but it has turned around pretty quick here. We wouldn't be doing justice, though, talking about the Nets, if we didn't mention KD and where this saga has gone over the course of a week here. It doesn't seem like he's going to move now. For the different suitors, whether it's Phoenix, whether it's Toronto's become a hot name, Miami wants to be involved, but it just doesn't seem like they have enough here. In Boston, like, their name isn't coming up, but they seem to make as much sense as anybody in terms of what they can offer and where they're at as a team and what player like Durant coming in might provide in terms of a boost. I'm off it just because it seems like the price is so astronomically high that acquiring Durant would basically bomb the depth of any team he ends up on, and that might even change his tune when it comes to his willingness to join another team here. But when you look at the teams that are mentioned alongside him or could potentially get involved here, does it make sense for a team, I guess, like Boston or like Phoenix, that's kind of on a doorstep of a championship, to acquire a player of his caliber, give up a ton of depth, and really remake the fabric of their team to get a guy that's been number one or number two but in the league, but is 33, 34 now, a couple of years after an Achilles tear?
I mean, I think for Phoenix, it's a little bit of a different equation because their window's kind of, you know, on a much tighter timeline. Chris Paul, you know, he's not going to be producing in the way that he was forever. So if you're really wanting to go all in and still win a championship, I think it makes a lot of sense for them. And especially given what it appears to be their relationship with Ayton is, I think that you probably do that. In Boston's case, you know, depending upon what the price is, you just went to the NBA finals with the core that you have. Now, that's not guaranteed. Obviously, we know that, you know, Chris Middleton wasn't playing for the Milwaukee Bucks. The Nets were kind of a dumpster fire to a degree. And I'm not trying to diminish
it. In pieces by the time.
Yeah, and I'm not diminishing at all what the Celtics did. They played who was in front of them. That's what you have to do. They showed that they were a good basketball team over the back half of the season. They went to the NBA finals and they didn't get swept in the NBA finals. So, but, you know, I think that you probably feel somewhat confident in the fact that, you know, Tatum and Brown have improved over the years. They seem to be hard workers. You would hope that they will continue to take those incremental steps. You've added Malcolm Brogdon to try to help that core a bit, that, you know, I might feel okay just continuing to ride that wave without going all in and sacrificing that degree of picks and other stuff for, you know, maybe I don't know that it necessarily guarantees you a championship if the Celtics have Kevin Durant. Nor do I think that the Celtics are disqualified from getting back to the NBA Finals if they don't have Kevin Durant. So, if I'm Phoenix, I'm smashing the yes button. If I'm the Celtics, I'm a little bit more hesitant, depending upon what they want in return.
So there you have it. Busy summer. We hit a lot of it over the week, or over 50 minutes here, an hour with Caitlin Cooper. You can find her. A lot of people, big fans in the chat, Caitlin, of your analysis here and your coverage, and a lot of people are. And you can find it at IndyCornrows.com as well as C2_Cooper on Twitter. That's been thrown in the chat already. You can go find it in there. Always great time talking with you, Caitlin. Fortunately, the Celtics and Pacers, it just always seems to overlap here between these two. And hopefully the Pacers will be at that top level of relevancy again in the playoffs or wherever that is soon. Great to have you here. Great talking to you, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.